Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Weekend Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Before we get started this morning, I'd like to remind you, devoted listeners, that the WAMC locked box is open and you can pledge anytime online at WAMC.org. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature some of your favorite panelists discussing important news items from the previous week. On Wednesday, May 29th, Joe is joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post.
Democratic Party leaders said Tuesday they would nominate President Biden for a second term in office via a virtual roll call of delegates to the party's national convention, bypassing a glitch in Ohio law that had threatened to keep Mr. Biden off the November ballot in the state. Ohio law requires all candidates to be legally certified by August 7th, but Mr. Biden was not scheduled to be officially nominated until after the Democratic National Convention begins on August 19th. The virtual roll call will be completed before the Ohio deadline. The party acted as the Ohio legislature was meeting in special session for the first time in two decades in an effort to pass legislation that would have resolved the ballot problem at the state level. The legislators had easily dealt with identical issues involving presidential candidates in 2012 and 2016, but deep divisions among Republicans had stalled any action for weeks. A frustrated Governor Mike DeWine, also a Republican, had summoned the legislators to the special session last week, calling their inability to end the legislative gridlock ridiculous and absurd. Only last week, the Speaker of the Ohio House, Representative Jason Stevens, was blunt about his inability to enact a quick fix for Mr. Biden's ballot problem. "There's just not the will to do that from the legislature," he told reporters on Wednesday. "It's a hyper-political environment at this time of year, and there are some Republicans who just didn't want to vote on it." The chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Jamie Harrison, issued a statement on Tuesday denouncing the Republican lawmakers for their inaction. Joe Biden will be on the ballot in Ohio and all 50 states, and Ohio Republicans agree. "But when the time has come for action, they have failed to act every time, so Democrats will land this plane on their own." I'm not sure I 100% understand the mechanism that the party is using that overrides the state legislature.
The legislature's state law in Ohio says they have to be nominated by their party by a certain date.
Right.
The legislature, the Republicans are at war with themselves in Ohio, and they couldn't do the right thing and pass a bill, because what, they only passed 14 or 17 bills the entire session, including making Warren G. Harding Day or something like that. So they did not pass a law, which they have done in the past, to change that date to accommodate the dates of conventions. So in 2020, the Democratic Party did a virtual roll call to nominate Biden because of COVID. And so they're just doing the same thing, making the decision before the deadline so Biden will be on the Ohio ballot. I mean, does that explain things, Joe?
It does. I just wonder why they wouldn't have done that in the first place instead of waiting on the legislature and even allowing it to be a problem.
Because it's about
the process.
Right.
It's a process.
Right. It's the original process, but it also gives the Biden campaign the opportunity to say, look how disorganized and disruptive and disassociated they are from reality, and they can't even agree amongst themselves.
Give them enough rope to hang themselves.
Yeah. Right. Well, but also it is a way to show that members of the Republican Party, a faction of them, do not want to even allow Biden to be a candidate in Ohio.
Right, right.
This is so... it's slimy.
Outrageous.
It's anti-democratic. I mean, you allow the opposing candidate of your party to run for election in this country, and apparently in Ohio they were trying to keep him off the ballot if possible. Well, they knew it wasn't going to be possible, but they tried, at least this group. And it's just so you know, it's an effort to weaken
democracy
in this country. It's just in the state of Ohio. It's like, you know, you can find it on the federal level, but you can certainly also find it in state on the state level and in local elections. And this is one of those sort of, I would consider it a slimy effort to weaken democratic standards in this country.
Not the party, but democracy.
Democracy, right.
I think it's also a preview of what we're going to be seeing over the next several months and what we're going to be seeing for several months following Election Day in November. It's important to remember that a presidential election is not one unified federal election. It is 50 parallel state elections, as well as District of Columbia and some of the territories that are happening at the same time that ultimately funnel into, let's hope, a decision as to who is going to be president. But that the states and the localities have so much to say about how these elections are administered and how results are decided and how those results are transmitted to Washington. And the lessons from 2020 were learned by both sides. And on the GOP side, they have spent a lot of time putting people in place in some of these decision-making positions on the state level, on the local level, even to make sure that there are people in polling stations, working at polling stations, there as observers. There is an entire effort that is underway to make sure that from their perspective that they don't make the same kind of mistakes that they made the last time, that there aren't Republicans in positions that they can't count on like we saw in the state of Georgia. So what we see in Ohio is just one blip, and we're going to see a lot more of it played out across the states. And it's another reason that, you know, elections to state legislatures is so important. We see, you know, relatively small amounts of attention paid to a lot of the races. And we see a lot of races for state legislatures, including in this state, where people are running unopposed or de facto unopposed, with no real opposition candidate. And that's bad for democracy, too. And it's also going to be bad in the run-up to the presidential election.
One of the things that I also was trying to figure out was the DNC figured out this workaround, but meanwhile, the Ohio legislature was still meeting in special session yesterday. They did ultimately pass a bill that would both allow Biden to appear on their general election ballot in November, but also bar foreign contributions to ballot issue campaigns. The latter was a direct response to GOP objections to the Issue One campaign last year that constitutionally protected abortion in the state. The move came without Democratic support, however, with members seemingly empowered to vote against the legislation following the DNC announcement. We don't need your fix. The DNC just released a statement several minutes ago that says we're going to hold a virtual vote of our delegates across the country and nominate President Biden to the ballot, said State Senator Bill DeMora. We don't want a legislative fix that holds the voters and their rights to the whim of the majority.
The whim of the majority.
Yes, yeah, okay.
Isn't it usually the whim of the minority?
Yes.
Like the tyranny of the minority, right?
It's amazing, right?
I don't know if I have to say this, but I'll just say it anyway. It's brilliant political commentary, which is it seems that getting the Democratic nominee on the ballot in a state may be more than a whim.
Perhaps.
And it seems like the Republican governor of the state agrees with that.
And Mike DeWine is not a Trumper.
No. He's actually a
Rockefeller
well-liked Republican governor of Ohio. And, you know, I mean, it gives you an indicator when people like him would say, this is a very strange concept here. But, you know, these kinds of publications about the whim of the majority, you know, if you don't pay close attention, you might actually find this appealing as just somebody who listens in casually to politics and says, yes, of course, my voice also matters, you know, and you sort of reverse ideas about who might actually want to have, you know, a right in this election. You know, I mean, the majority should determine the outcome of the election and not the minority, as far as I can tell.
Republican Governor Mike DeWine still urges a legislative remedy to the ballot amid ballot access concerns. Quote, while I understand the Democratic National Committee has just today proposed a workaround to help get President Biden on the Ohio ballot, it is prudent legislation to be passed to get this done. As I previously said, we do not want to leave something so basic as having the sitting president of the United States on the ballot to others when this can and should be done legislatively. It's the right thing to do.
There you go.
Except for a majority of the Republicans at the state legislature who believe that it should not be the case.
Because they're doing Trump's bidding. They're not being good representatives. They're not upholding democracy. They're following the leader.
I think that they're probably also responding to the constituents in their districts who are...
I'm not so sure about that.
I was going to say, what does that tell us about Ohio?
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I think that this really is just let's screw Biden any way we can.
And I don't know Ohio well enough to know.
And you know, I don't think the constituents are saying, let's do this and tear down our democracy. Some, maybe. But I think most people are like, we need to have an election. This is how you do it.
I mean, you should have two candidates for president on the ballot there.
Right.
Yeah.
I do think that DeWine's that line about we don't want to leave something so basic as having the sitting president of the United States on the ballot when we can do this legislatively seems pretty simple, doesn't it? From the New York Times, Harvard, as in the Harvard University, says it will no longer take positions on matters outside of the university. The policy could ease pressure on the school to issue statements on current events. Officials were criticized for their handling of the October 7th Hamas attacks. Harvard said on Tuesday that it would now avoid taking positions on matters that are, quote, not relevant to the core function of the university. This is an acceptance of the recommendations of a faculty committee that urged the university to dramatically reduce its messages on issues of the day. If put into practice, Harvard would no longer issue official statements of empathy, which it did for Ukraine after the Russian invasion and for the victims of the October 7th Hamas attacks in Israel, for example. In issuing official statements of empathy, the university runs the risk of appearing to care more about some places and events than others, the report said. And because few, if any, world events can be entirely isolated from conflicting viewpoints, issuing official empathy statements runs the risk of alienating some members of the community by expressing implicit solidarity with others. So for God's sakes, no empathy.
Yes. Right. That's just how I feel about
please
that, too.
Don't,
no empathy.
No empathy.
Let's not express any support for suffering human humans anywhere on human rights issues or anything along those
lines. We got our own problems.
Yes.
Screw them. No empathy. Jim, you may have a more nuanced idea on this.
I don't know if it's more nuanced, but... So, you know, I do think that universities had gotten themselves into a difficult situation when they got into the business of issuing statements on current events. And in that article that you're citing, Joe, Noah Feldman from Harvard Law School says, you know, universities are not governments. A university school or department is not the State Department. They don't need to take a position on these kinds of events. And so I agree with that. I think that's just on the face of it. It's true. But my colleague at Barr, Jonathan Becker, is just out with an article. The timing is excellent with regard to Harvard's decision. Jonathan's article came out just recently, and the title of it is Deeds, Not Words. And he's saying, okay, yes, we don't need to issue statements. It's counterproductive. But that doesn't mean that these institutions that are so important to not only our society, but American higher education, so important to the world, should be neutral. In fact, with their actions, with their resources, with the prestige and credibility of these institutions, they can take action. They can put things in place that are not neutral, that in fact do seek to address some of the key issues of our day, and that this is fitting and appropriate for an institution of higher education to do, and for higher education writ large to do. And so if we're talking about prison education, students' rights to vote, the welcoming of refugees and immigrants into our institutions, access to higher education, irrespective of financial resources. These are all the kinds of things that universities can and should do, and in many cases, including at Bard College, they are doing. And that's not neutrality. That is taking a position, but making it real and not just making a statement. So I urge the listeners to go find that article by Jonathan Becker. It's really very, very good. And I think it's the piece of this story that Harvard was not addressing.
Becker argues that while institutions cannot and should not, quote, issue proclamations on every social and political issue of the day, Bard College models a counter-tradition of institutional engagement, quote, rooted in liberal education and civic learning that other colleges and universities could follow. Quote, by embracing their role as civic actors, colleges and universities can place more emphasis on their deeds than on their words, allowing their civic work to represent their priorities and their commitment to important local, national, and global challenges.
And this isn't separate from the educational mission. Mm-hmm. This is at the core of that educational mission.
I would agree with that because, you know, educational institutions, especially of higher learning, have core values that they're based on, foundational values. At Siena College, we clearly have a Franciscan position on human rights and social justice and environmental protections. And those kinds of statements that are released by the leadership or faculty committees or collaborative statements by faculty and students represent those values. Not everything is released as a public statement like the State Department for the general audience. We also communicate back to our own students and to our own communities and to, you know, in our case as a Franciscan institution, we stand for particular values at Siena College. And we implement them through the ECAR, Every Campus a Refuge program that we have, where we hosted, you know, for 18 months, an Afghan refugee family with children. And we have environmental agendas that we pronounce, and we have, for example, UN Secretary General Guterres coming and speaking to us in the fall, and we have a major conference coming around, you know, on our campus, and we communicate that out. We represent values. We represent positions, and I think I find it rather sad that an institution with so much money as Harvard shies away because of public criticism. What they have to do is communicate basic values. What do we stand for as an institution? What do we educate our students in? What is our mission as an institution? Now, we don't have to release statements on every political event, but we have to stand for specific values. And if we shy away from supporting people that are being bombed in Ukraine, then what do we mean by that? If we shy away from doing fundraisers or speaking up for children that in Palestine or in Gaza need medical support, what are we shying away from? When are we not calling on hostages to be released by Hamas? What do we shy away from? We shy away from fundamental positions that every human life counts, whether you know, whether entangled in warfare, suffering from ecological deprivation, poverty, and, you know, if we don't make statements on that, who are we? And are we true leaders in community?
Libby.
Well, I think Harvard's response was what Harvard was a response to the weaponization of higher ed by Elise Stefanik. And I think, you know, it put a chilling effect on a lot of those higher level or, you know, Ivy League, whatever you want to call them, schools, especially the ones where their women presidents ended up losing their jobs. And you here you have, you know, Elise Stefanik, a woman, supposedly, you know, championing anti-Semitism when she, championing, fighting against anti-Semitism when she's never said a word about it, ever, until now, because it's politically expedient. And so what happens is, you know, they talk about weaponizing government. Stefanik and the Republicans have weaponized higher education against the very institutions that are supposed to uphold the values of higher education. And it's about fear. It really is about fear.
Libby Post on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 29. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, May 30th, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Hartwick College and Co-Director of Hartwick College's new Institute of Public Service, Laurel Elder, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and rising senior majoring in Human Rights at Bard College, Svetlana Kukaruk.
Justice Samuel Alito, he's a justice on the United States Supreme Court and has been part of a controversy over the last several weeks, although the actual actions have been taking place for years, where there have been flags that often associate with far-right theories and conspiracy theories that have been flown over his house. Or houses, one of his main house, one in a New Jersey summer home, and so he did the first salvo in this was I didn't do it; it was my wife. And then more and more Democrats and others said, "Well, if you're talking about the subverting the election of 2020." Maybe if the court is hearing these cases and this is how you feel about it, that you should recuse yourself from the Supreme Court. And the last several days has been a mounting call for Justice Alito to recuse himself from these cases regarding the January 6th
insurrection.
Insurrection, thank you. To look at that and say, okay, maybe it's time for you to just sit on the sidelines. And so yesterday, with great fanfare, Justice Alito said no, that he will not recuse himself. He told this to Congress yesterday. And there were several congressional leaders, mostly Democrats, I think all Democrats, saying that he should recuse himself. And Alito said that he could be impartial after an upside-down flag flew at his home following the 2021 U.S. Capitol attack. I do want to get to the... this is the line. There are a couple of quotes here. As soon as I saw it, I asked my wife to take it down, but for several days she refused. Alito wrote in a letter to Senators Dick Durbin and Sheldon Whitehouse, who oversee the federal courts in their respective roles as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee and a Judicial Oversight Subcommittee. My wife is fond of flying flags. I am not. He added, my wife was solely responsible for having flagpoles put at our residence and our vacation home and has flown a wide variety of flags over the years. The upside-down flag, long used as a signal of distress, especially by the U.S. military, has become a symbol of the Stop the Steal movement that falsely claims the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. Another flag carried by January 6th rioters, this one embraced by Christian nationalists who want to find a greater place for religion in public life, was flown outside Alito's vacation home in New Jersey last summer. So, Laura, let's begin with you. So it's all Mrs. Alito's fault.
Well, that seems to be part of the story that Justice Alito is telling. I mean, he tried to make, I think, a pretty persuasive, and some people might find this compelling case that his wife, Mrs. Alito, is a private citizen. She herself is not a Supreme Court justice, and she likes flags. She likes flying flags. She's flown many different ones. And, you know, he's like, she's a private citizen. She should be able to fly flags, and I support her ability to do so. But that, of course, misses the point, which is this is not a controversy about whether or not Mrs. Alito has the right to fly flags. She, of course, she does. She's a private citizen, and at her own home, the government can't interfere with her right to fly whatever flag she wants. But the issue here is whether Justice Alito should recuse himself from cases relating to Donald Trump and the January 6th insurrection and efforts to overturn the election. And that's a completely different issue. And the guidance or the rules from Congress that apply to all the federal judges, except the Supreme Court, because they see themselves as exempt, say that if there's an appearance of a conflict of interest, you should recuse yourself from the case. And so, you know, Justice Alito is saying, no, even though my wife has flown these flags, I can still be impartial. But the point is, it has the appearance of being, you know, a problem, of being biased. And so I think many people who are concerned with government ethics and judicial ethics would like to see him recuse himself. And of course, this is also important because the legitimacy of the courts and the perception of its legitimacy by the American public is its greatest source of power.
We are talking about the story about Justice Alito, United States Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, who told Congress yesterday he will not recuse himself from January 6th related cases after many called for that as a result of flags that were flying at his house. We did hear from Laurel Elder just a moment ago about her thoughts on this issue, the upside down flag, as well as the flag embraced by Christian nationalists and what that means. Malia.
So there is, to my understanding, a precedent, a Supreme Court precedent that directly relates to this from 2009. It's a case called Caperton versus A.T. Massey Coal Company, where the Supreme Court found that even though there was no evidence that a judge in that case was actually biased, that he should recuse himself anyway because of the appearance of bias that he had received a large election donation. This is in one of those places where judges are elected. So they found no evidence of bias despite this large campaign donation by one of the parties to the lawsuit. The Supreme Court decided no, the judge should recuse himself anyway. So I hope that we have some legal scholars who are listening in who can write in about whether that precedent is actually directly relevant in this case. But it seems to me that it is, just on you know, what I've read about it. And so I don't quite understand Samuel Alito's protestations. It just seems half-hearted and not really dedicated to the integrity of the actual judicial system. I don't know why he wouldn't abide by this seemingly direct relevant precedent.
Jamie Raskin, the congressperson from Maryland, had a pretty substantial op-ed in the New York Times, I think, yesterday. Raskin's also a fairly well-known constitutional scholar, maintaining that there are mechanisms that are at the disposal of the U.S. Attorney's Office, that they can file petition to under the due process clause of the Constitution, and there's some sort of federal law that would indeed require Alito to recuse himself, and Clarence Thomas, too. Let's make it clear about what's happening here. We've both got Clarence Thomas and Alito, who have indicated very clearly where they stood on the insurrection of from 2020. You know, I'd love to see what other flags Martha Ann loves to fly. I mean, we know about two. The judge says she likes many flags, and I wanted to make the point that while he respects her opinion to her First Amendment rights to express her opinion, he also didn't respect it enough to let her continue to fly the flag. He asked for it to be taken down. I imagine there was some discussion, and eventually it came down. I mean, in my profession, in the journalism world, even the appearance of a slightest bias, you are not supposed to go there. This is very clear bias. You are not supposed to. Do they have bumper stickers on their cars? Let's do some real looking at it. This is in part a reflection of the white glove treatment the media has given the Supreme Court for decades. I mean, the fact that the Washington Post knew about this story 3 years ago or when it first happened and said, nah, no story here. We need to take a harder look at this court.
And do you think it was no story because it was pre January 6th, although even the flag flew after that as well?
That's the excuse they use. But I believe that this is because, this is the justice. I'm sure that this was probably the wife. This is just a neighborhood dispute. Let's tone this down. The reporter who first found about it was a Supreme Court justice, and those guys tend to revere those justices. And I do not think that's healthy for holding them accountable.
I told the story on the air the other day that when I was in fourth grade at Stony Creek Elementary School in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, Stephen Rabney went out to put the flag up. It was his week, and he went out and put the flag up and accidentally put it out upside down. And the community went nuts. And everyone was called in, and that was taken care of very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have such things in place.
We in America seem to be obsessed with flags, though, isn't it? It seems like, I think if you go to a European country, you don't see houses with flags outside their outside. It's not something we do here for some reason.
Well, you remember, I mean, after 9/11, this isn't a bad thing, but 9/11, everyone was flying a flag. Mm-hmm. And then, they were taping them to their cars and everything else. And you drive down the highway and they'd just be littered off to the side of the road. And the thought of even people who are flying the flags out of the back of their pickup trucks, well, okay, that's fine, but still treat them with respect and the respect that comes with flying the United States flag. Take it down when it's raining. Fold it correctly.
Right.
All of those things that are expected as procedural things that we expect for the United States.
So I just want to point out that, you mentioned, Judy, the sort of hands-off treatment that has, but that's partly because there aren't the same level of rules and laws governing the behavior of the civilian employees in the judicial system, as there are in other parts of our government. So as a former federal employee myself, I was subject to the stipulations of the Hatch Act, which has been around since 1939 and very clearly lays out what I am and am not allowed to do. It's the full name of it is, just to give you a sense of what this, the Hatch Act, an act to prevent pernicious political activities. So
pernicious.
Yes, that's, I love that word, pernicious. And so it's very clear about what, in an effort to safeguard the integrity of the federal government, where the civilian employees, such as myself, I was not a political appointee. I was a permanent civil service hire. That we are meant to be nonpartisan, and we serve the government, we serve the public interest of the United States. And so the Hatch Act was designed to help safeguard that by preventing people in those kind of roles from doing certain things, like wearing certain like political kinds of t-shirt, or depending where you are, you do have rights as a private citizen that you don't give up, but it's laid out very clearly where you can and can't exercise those rights. And there isn't something, to my understanding, there isn't something similar for the judicial branch of the government. That's for executive branch folks.
Svetlana, what do you make of this, of the American perspective of flags and extrapolating it to our Supreme Court?
This is something that I noticed when I came to the U.S. for the first time. I saw a lot of huge U.S. flags, and it's something that I...
Yeah, mostly in front of car dealerships. Yes. The bigger ones are in front of car dealerships. I don't know why, but that seems to be a thing.
Does that happen in your country?
When the full-scale invasion began, I would say that we had much more flags. People were just hanging them up on their balconies, out of the windows. And in Europe, people were doing it as well to support Ukraine. But another interesting thing that I noticed is that how people in the U.S. are free about expressing their political views. And when you are driving on the road and you see these houses, and a lot of them have the sign next to them that kind of expresses whom they are going to support or what political views they have. And I think that this is not that common in Ukraine.
Yeah. And that is a relatively new phenomenon as far as, I mean, we could talk about the American flag, the use of the American flag, or even the Christian national flag, but it's a relatively new phenomenon, I think, that after Trump, of flying the Trump flag and flying the F. Biden flag and flying the don't tread on me. That all seems to have come recently.
Yeah, like the whole, in this area, painting the side of the barn kind of thing, which I don't recall seeing prior to the last election that much.
Or the hay bales.
Yeah, or the hay bales, that's right.
There's probably a flag manufacturer behind all this.
All right. Well, we have many letters. I'll get to a couple of them, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll return to more. Janet writes, good morning. While Mrs. Alito may have raised both flags, she raised them on the Alito property, and Justice Alito did not remove them. Isn't this giving consent for their presence as well as their message? Well, I think that's the core of the argument, right? I mean, I think that's exactly one of the questions that is at the center of this.
You know, in the meantime, today's Thursday, and typically we get Supreme Court decisions on Thursdays. We'll see what decisions come out today and what Judge Alito has to opine about.
We're still waiting on the immunity, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's the big one that we're waiting for, so...
Yeah, I think that this timing is really tricky because, yeah, the Supreme Court is going to be issuing a series of incredibly important decisions in the coming weeks. And another way the Supreme Court is different than the other branches is that they don't really have enforcement power. It's just the nine of them in black robes. They make decisions, and usually we all follow their decisions, city governments, state governments, corporations, individuals, because once again, that we recognize them as the legitimate interpreter of the Constitution and our laws. And so the legitimacy of the Supreme Court has been, waning, and I think a lot of Alito's colleagues are very deeply concerned about this and have been doing a lot of public outreach to try to restore its legitimacy. And so I can only imagine that Justice Alito's colleagues, some of them are really upset about this as further undermining their legitimacy in the eyes of many Americans.
Laurel Elder on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, May 30th. We'll be back with the final segment of this morning's show after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, Joe Donahue was joined for the panel discussion by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be ruled a felon, ending his series of lucky breaks in cases by three states and the federal government. Mr. Trump was convicted in Manhattan of falsifying records to cover up a sex scandal that threatened his 2016 campaign. At about 4:20, a little bit before then, the judge, Juan Merchan, walked to check on the jury and got a note because he was ready to let them go for the day. And the jury reported, "We think we're close to a verdict. We are. We have a verdict. Can we have a half hour to fill out the paperwork?" The judge said yes, and just moments later, the jury returned about 5 p.m. as 12 jurors found Mr. Trump guilty on all 34 counts. As the verdict was announced by the jury foreman, there was almost no reaction from Mr. Trump. Two rows of friends, family, and aides. Mr. Trump sat slack and glum at the defense table. On the bench behind him, his son Eric shook his head from side to side. The courtroom was silent as the foreman repeatedly announced, as Teresa started to reenact,
"Guilty,
guilty,
guilty,
guilty, guilty." On 34 counts, 11 counts related to invoices from Michael Cohen, 11 counts related to checks, 12 counts related to ledger entries. There are many things to discuss on this. First of all, how did we get here? I think, again, this was a surprise for many. We talked about all the possibilities. Many of us, I think, I'm not ascribing this to any one panelist, but I think generally as a group, most people thought it was going to end in a hung jury. It did not. And it was overwhelming and happened pretty quickly. So those are things that we want to talk about. Then we want to talk about appeals. We want to talk about what's next. We want to talk about the other cases. So there's a lot to discuss as we move forward on this Friday morning. Sienna, let me begin with you because you were with us earlier as we were sort of staring off into the television as the jury was just getting the case and about to begin their deliberations. And then less than 48 hours came out with this verdict.
Which is usually a sign that it's going to be a guilty verdict, right? The quicker they come back, the more absolute the jury is. I think also what was a sign was when they came back with their very pointed questions, to get information during their deliberation. They were asking about what happened with the David Pecker conversation. They were asking about to clarify the jury instructions about inferences and what kind of inferences they could make from the evidence. And so they were very, very specific about what they were asking for. And, you know, we were all trying to guess what these requests meant and whether it meant they were going to be a hung jury. And they came back with a complete verdict. I have to say I was very shocked. You know, we always said since the beginning that this was one of the cases that we thought was, I wouldn't say the weakest, but, you know, it was the case that was first to be indicted on. But it was, we were always like, we never knew how we felt about this case. But the prosecution did an excellent, excellent job. I think it was very helpful, as they do in all New York cases, that they were allowed to go last and just take their time and explain why Michael Cohen's testimony specifically was corroborated and corroborated well. I think Pecker going first was a very good strategy. So I think the DA did a very, very good job in this case. And the complete verdict that came back and the conviction that came back is reflective of that.
One of the things that I thought was really was interesting, I kept on thinking of something that you were saying, that as the jury was getting the instructions from the judge, the 34 counts, and you said, well, you could spend a day on each of those counts. You could spend a lot of time on each one of those. But obviously that wasn't the case.
And I mean, if you think about the way the counts are laid out, it's all document based. I mean, I think one section is related to checks, another one is, you know, the recording. So what we were looking for is, and I've heard other legal experts say it as well, is once they saw that they were coming back on counts 1, 2, and 3, which were checks issued by the trust, then they kind of knew that the rest would be guilty verdicts. Because when you were issued by the trust, that was the furthest away Trump got from that. So it was, once you heard count 1 guilty, which, by the way, each count holds up to, can take up to a max of 4 years in jail. So each count, four years, which is, he's not going to get, you guys. But
no, he's not going to.
Should I put my pom-poms down?
Put them down. He's not going to get them. But I'm just saying, once you knew that counts 1 through 11, which were checks issued by the trust, were going through, you knew the rest was going to go through. So, I mean, I screenshot the first count when it said guilty. I was like, oh, okay, we have one. And yeah. I was like, oh, here we go.
But, well, they did the first five together when I heard it. And I was like, oh, okay. So this is where we're headed. And then I thought, oh, well, that's 5 out of 34. He's still a convicted felon at this point. And then the cascade just continued. And I was, as you said, shocked.
And then the defense attorney polled the jury to make sure that each jury member agreed with this verdict. And they were all very assertive. And they said, yes, we do. So, I mean, I think that was also another telling moment for the defense. But we still expect that they're going to do a motion to set aside the trial. And I know everyone wants to know what happens next. Well, what happens next is actually really interesting. Trump has to go and do an interview with the probation office because the probation office makes a recommendation to the judge. And then on July 11th, we'll see the prosecution making a recommendation to the judge. Also on July 11th, they'll probably hear the motion to set aside the trial from the defense. And then the judge is going to make their ruling.
I want to get to our other panelists, but just a quick question about the July 11th. Is there a chance that that date gets moved?
I don't think so. Not in his courtroom. I don't see that he's going to move it.
And the reason I ask that question is because it's just days before the Republican National Convention, and I think the Trump team wanted to have it moved.
But didn't the Trump team also agree to that date earlier?
Yes.
Yeah. I think they both, yeah. I think for them it's theatrics.
All right, Mark Whitman.
Well, Joe, if you look at the counts, they're really, and we've talked about this before on the program, there are checks that were falsified, there are invoices that were falsified, and there are ledger entries that were falsified. So it's really, you could count it as 34. It's really sort of three times they went and lied on the books and did it multiple times. So frankly, once they came back with, I thought it was all or nothing all along in terms of if they would either convict him or find him innocent. I found the commentary interesting. I don't think you had to believe much, if any, of Michael Cohen to get there. I think a lot of the commentary, frankly, sells juries, at least the one experience I had, would suggest that the commentary sold the jury pretty short. You know, the fact that, well, Michael Cohen has lied in the past doesn't mean he's incapable of telling the truth, and doesn't mean that, frankly, most people aren't capable of discerning when somebody who's a little slippery is telling the truth and maybe not. I think the jury cut through that. I don't think they needed to be overly reliant on Michael Cohen. And so, to me, the guilty verdict was not really a surprise. The facts here are pretty obvious. I've said it before. I think this is very fertile grounds for appeal, and maybe we could go into that in a second round of discussion points. But I think the likelihood that this stands up is at best a coin flip on appeal, and that those appeals will take a year to 18 months to go through.
At least.
Yeah. I did think that immediate reaction of the Speaker of the House saying that this was an unfortunate outcome was at best, you know, it saddened me, frankly. But it wasn't surprising. It's one thing to show up and be supportive of somebody at trial, but it's another thing is literally the Speaker of the House to denigrate what happened in this process, particularly at the trial level.
A judicial system that by all accounts, and I know people could disagree with this, certainly allies for Trump will probably disagree with this, but the jury seemed to just have their act together, right? I mean, it was like we were expecting a circus in the beginning. It was a bit of a circus, but even that, as far as when the jury selection process was underway, it started to go, and after that, we were good, and so I think, we have to respect that, right? We have to respect that process.
I mean, it's the cornerstone of our justice system is the jury and being judged by your peers, and they did that in this case.
Teresa Bourgeois.
Yeah, I don't know why, but I was surprised by the verdict in the sense that I thought there'd be one or two jurors who, you know, kind of Trump people and would hold out. But the evidence seemed to me so clear. I think the Pecker testimony was crystal clear. And they had the receipts. They had the details. We knew going into it because it had already been public. And so Cohen's testimony was important but not essential. And I did, as they were reading the verdict, I was thinking of what's Hillary Clinton thinking right now. I think that'd be interesting. But it also seems...
Oh, I think we know what she's thinking.
Yeah. Like, you know, I was right. And then as three things. What was Hillary Clinton thinking? And I was thinking... this is so on brand. You know, Trump's all about being on brand, but it's so consistent. You know, it's consistent with the way he didn't pay his contractors. It's consistent with, you know, Trump University, which he had to pay out millions of dollars in settlements for that being improper. It was consistent with his charity convictions. It was consistent with him being found guilty of sexual assault in the E. Jean Carroll and then defamation. I mean, there's just such a consistency around his behavior. What's different is that for so long he's had these behaviors and hasn't been held accountable, and finally he is. And then the last thing I thought about is, you know, their children watching. You know, what does this say about this as a candidate for the president of the United States? And what does it say about when you hear Speaker Johnson and others talk about, essentially denigrate our jury system, denigrate and hold up a person who behaves in the way that Trump does. And I think we can do better as a country. And I think that in the end, the jury has spoken. It's fundamental to our system, and we have to believe it.
What is the possibility of this being overturned? What is I mean, 100% he's going to appeal, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
absolutely.
His tweets have already said that.
Yeah. Right. So and that's what you do, right? That's exactly what you do. So no surprises there. And now the question is, where will this court and the basis for the appeal and what, if there is anything given, and I am going to make an assumption here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but given the overwhelming nature of it, all 34 counts guilty, does that in any way hamper an appeal in the sense of that it would be different if the charges were much more varied?
Yes, I agree. I think that if it was not a complete verdict, that it would, I think it would be easier appeal in the New York state. Like, we're going to have a conversation in a little bit, but for New York, I think it would have been easier appeal for the defense. I think it's a harder appeal here because in order for you to have a conviction overturned, it has to be clearly erroneous. That's the standard of the Court of Appeals. What happens next is they're going to appeal to the First Department. We expect that the First Department will probably respond by January 2025, and then they're going to appeal further up to the Court of Appeals, and that's the long wait. That's how long it probably will take for them to get a, 12 months, 18 months, for them to get a response from the Court of Appeals. So, and the only way the Court of Appeals will overturn a conviction is if it's clearly erroneous. And so, like, in the past, you've seen them overturn convictions when the, for example, I think the most recent one was a defendant, the judge closed the courtroom and it violated the defendant's right to a public trial, right? So that's the way they were able to get that conviction overturned. So, I mean, those are your thinking about the rights. Those are where you typically see your overturning. But the factual nature of this case that the jury decided on, it had to be clearly erroneous. And I don't think that they could reach that. They could meet that burden.
And it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the judge, it was a very carefully managed case.
You know, I think the judge did a very good job of making sure that Trump had all his rights. And then some, right? And so I think that's why it would be hard. I can't see any due process issues just facially. Just from what I've seen so far, that would allow it to be overturned for due process, because that's what you're looking for when you're, you know, that's the easiest thing to go for. That's the low hanging fruit for a defense attorney, is if the court did something that jeopardized your the defendant's due process rights. And so when you don't have that, now you have to go up to the facts. And when the Court of Appeals is looking at that, it has to be clearly erroneous. And I don't think they could find that in this case.
I think if you look at this case in aggregate, we all acknowledge that when Trump started getting indicted, his poll numbers went up. If it is not the, if it turns out to be the case that the independents who said they may leave Trump if he's convicted, if they don't leave, Alvin Bragg will have contributed a net positive to Trump's standing. I actually think there's better than even money chance that this thing is overturned on appeal, not because of what happened in the court, but because of the underlying statute. And let's just examine the underlying statute. The underlying statute allowed the state to take what I'll call three misdemeanors. When I say three, checks, the ledgers, the invoices. You can multiply them by how many times he signed it, but let's just say three main acts. Take those acts, which are not a felony, and make them a felony because they were in furtherance of another crime. But I would challenge anyone before you come out too strong on this to read the jury instructions. They're actually pretty simple to read. And if you go to the last sort of 15 pages, you get the crux of the instructions as they related to the underlying law. The jury did not have to conclude unanimously which illegal activity the falsification of records was in furtherance of. So, look, I'm not a Trump fan. I cheered. I think what he did was wrong. Let me be clear about that. But I don't think this statute stands on review. I also take strong exception when the legal analysts on TV say that the court found that the jury found that Trump violated business records in order to affect an election. You cannot conclude that from this decision unless and until you poll all 12 jurors.
Mark Whitman on the roundtable panel on Friday, May 31st. The WAMC Locked Box is open now with a full fund drive beginning on June 10th. You can contribute anytime online at wamc.org. This has been the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.